Chapter 8, The Anatomy of No, Logical Conquest Over Rejection. Have you ever walked away mystified after presenting an idea to someone and the person refused to agree with it or to buy it? You cannot believe the person said no. You fail to understand the thinking that would lead to such a decision. I would imagine that even if you are the best salesperson or the most confident individual, you would admit that most times when people say no to you, it bugs you to some degree. You do not feel dejected, rejected, or inadequate, because you now have learned how to avoid those destructive emotions through playing the mind games that we discussed in the previous chapter. However, at times the refusal bugs you because you don't understand it. It may even seem very illogical at times. So while the previous chapter provides emotional conquest over rejection, let us now seek logical conquest over rejection by cutting into the anatomy of that bug called no. When you understand the most typical thinking and feelings that make people say no to you, then you will be better positioned to anticipate and to avoid such responses. In other words, you will have learned how to get yes more often. So let's talk about the anatomy of the bug called no. When someone says no to you, the primary reason almost always falls into one of three areas. Now, for the sake of illustration, let's regard those areas as the three anatomical areas or parts of a bug: the head, the thorax, and the abdomen. The head is the thinking, the thorax is the central positioning, and the abdomen is the gut feel. Now, in your book, Persuasion Power, please turn now to page 128, and you will have a complete summary of all the pieces of what we're about to discuss in a diagram. You will see the bug, you will see the different sections of the bug in its anatomy, and then you will see the 13 predominant reasons why people say no to you. And then in the final column to the right, you will see where the solutions lie. So stop the tape now, stop the CD, stop the sound, and go to page 128. Welcome back. Now, while this section seems to deal with the negative or the no, do not be fooled. The material that I'm about to share with you is very positive, and it can drive you to action. Read carefully and listen carefully, and you will discover a wide array of selling strategies that can improve your results. We will examine the structure of no, but we will do it from the perspective of getting yes. So let's begin with the head of this bug called no, the head, the thinking that leads to no. As indicated in the chart on page 128, the possible solution to the first set of negative responses lies in how effectively you make the pitch or the presentation or you present your case, how well you perform the five steps of persuasive presentation power that we discussed in an earlier chapter. Recall that the five steps of persuasive presentation power are the following. 1. Reviewing the situation. 2. The proposition. 3. How it works. 4. What's in it for me. And of course, 5. Next steps. Now let us proceed to take apart each source of negative response that you might receive to your presentations. I mentioned earlier that there are 13 predominant reasons why people will say no to you. The first 8 of them come from the head, the thinking of the person or the audience to whom you're presenting, and the solution typically lies in presentation. So the first of those 8 questions is, no, I'm not interested. When your idea is turned down due to a lack of interest, typically, there's one predominant thing that's missing in your presentation, and that is, it is step one in the five steps of persuasive presentation power. Typically, it's because you have not properly done your job with the situation review. When you effectively show a person his or her present situation of need, constraint, desires, fears, suspicions, or challenges, when you push those buttons, and then you clearly link the advantages of your proposition to make solutions appear to lessen the pain, the person is almost naturally interested. It is through that connection that your presentation becomes relevant and meaningful. Until this point is established, it does not matter how good your idea is. It doesn't matter how high the quality of your product is. It doesn't matter how easy it is to implement your suggestion or even how much money it can make for the person to whom you're presenting. Relevancy is the first order of business, or you're going to invite no. Remind me of my thirst. Illustrate the effects of the dryness of my throat. Show me the blazing sun, and then dramatize the benefits of your water, and I may still not buy, but at least you have my immediate interest. My interest increases the probability that I will say yes. Reason number two, no, I can't see it working. The customer or prospect that perceives complexity in your proposition is unlikely to buy it. Life is full of things that are hard, complicated, and demanding. We have jobs and bills and, oh my gosh, relationships, on and on, very complicated and very hard things. If I suspect that when I say yes to your idea, it will complicate my work, or it will make some other aspect of my life hard to handle, I'm already inclined to say no to you, or at least to postpone the decision. The solution to this situation lies in steps number 2, 3, and 4 of the 5-step process. Step number 2 requires that you make sure the proposition is easy to understand. Avoid presenting 10-part programs to your buyer. 10 parts. It's too much to take in all at once. If your entire program requires a series of steps or parts, then sell the overall idea and leave the parts to be explained later. Typically, you never sell parts or steps. Instead, you sell the total effect of those parts or those steps. So why let the parts prevent the sale of the whole? The next thing to do is to be certain that you explain the way that the idea works simply and concisely. That's step number 3. At this point, it may be necessary to go briefly through the various steps in a multi-part process as you do your presentation. So, for example, you're selling a summer display program for your hair care sweepstakes program to be displayed in a retail store. In truth and in fact, there may be a number of steps that may include choosing the device for the display, getting authorization of the store supervisors, determining product distribution quantities by store, figuring out the inventory needed for ordering, merchandising, building displays, submitting the sweepstake entries, doing the drawings in store, submitting the sweepstake winners for the company to pay, and on, you may have a number of steps. If you have 5 steps or 10 steps or 15 steps in your program, for the sake of simplicity, subdivide the list into 3 stages or 3 phases. Show how it works in 3 parts, each of which has its own sub-steps. So you may still end up with 15 steps, but you present 3 groupings. For example, your 3 phases may be authorization, preparation, and implementation. And below each one, there are a number of sub-steps. Or they may be before, during, and after. Again, simplicity is the objective here. Finally, be sure that in step 4, which is, what's in it for me, you secure agreement on a few simple actions that are necessary to get the process started, to get the process rolling. All the buyer has to do is to agree with the first few actions that are needed to make the idea become a reality. And here is a critical point to remember. If the idea you're selling is not simple to you, then you will be in a great bind. It will be virtually impossible to demonstrate that it's simple to the customer or to the prospect if it doesn't make sense to you on a very simple level. If you think it's complicated, or if you're not sufficiently familiar with the details to understand it thoroughly, then it is more likely that such lack of clarity will lead the buyer to say, nah, it's too complicated. Believe in your own product, your own service, your own ideas. Become an expert at the particulars without being trapped in explaining all the details. And now, figure out how you can explain it to a layman or to a novice. Then, it's much more likely that you will get yes. Reason number three. Nah, you're asking too much. Peter tried to recruit Mary to a wonderful business opportunity in his network marketing company. And he invited her to attend the National Training Convention in Detroit, Michigan. Mary was excited, but she was still somewhat uncertain about that decision. Her cost to join the business was $499. Not a lot of money, but still it was not negligible. She thought about joining, but then she reflected on this Detroit thing. Well, that would cost another $129 for admission, plus it would cost $900 for round-trip airfare and paying for hotel and paying for food and taxi fares. Besides, she was very busy already, and by joining the business, she would be immediately committing to a weekend out of town. It all sounded like it was too big a decision to make right away, and so she decided to wait and think about it a little more. Well, that happened last year. Peter is still wondering why she was so excited initially and she has done nothing for a whole year. Let us consider this. If you want to sell a horse and a saddle and a bridle and ropes and horseshoes, here's how you do it. Find somebody who wants a horse. Sell the horse. Then demonstrate to the person the need to protect that investment and then sell the horseshoes. Delight the owner with the pleasure of riding the horse comfortably and then sell the saddle. And then you may want to emphasize the need for safety while riding and sell the bridle and the ropes. Say what? Doesn't that require too much work? You think so? Okay, here's another approach. Find someone who wants a horse. Sell the horse. Now package the saddle, bridle, ropes, horseshoes, and all the other accessories as one value-added packaged offer. Sell the equipment package after selling the horse and offer a 25% discount to buy it all. Say what? It's still less effort to sell the entire combination of having a horse equipped with everything? The answer is no. That's the approach of the average and the non-strategic salesperson. You see, the entire combination of the horse and all its accessories is too much to swallow for many people who want to buy just a horse. There are fewer buyers who will buy the entire combination of horse and equipment. Some may already have their own horse equipment. Some cannot afford the total price when you combine it all. So offer the horse and expose yourself to the greater probability of making the chief sale, the main sale. The worst case scenario is that you sell the horse and you have difficulty selling the equipment. That's not so bad, considering that the horse is the far greater value that you want to sell. Make the sale without choking the buyer. Let me give you an illustration. My daughter, Danielle, instinctively understood this sales dynamic when she was 10 years old. She would say to me, Daddy, can I go to Carrie's birthday party? And then 5 minutes after getting yes from her father, to something that was really a simple request, going to a birthday party, she would come back sweetly and say, Could you give me some money to buy her a birthday gift, please, please, please? And about 15 minutes after negotiating that prize, she would add one more thing. Can I stay overnight at Carrie's house? At 10 years old, my daughter understood and used a strategy that some grown-up salespeople still do not understand. The most important thing she wanted was to go to the party. So she asked for that first. She knew that mixing in the idea of free money plus an overnight stay would provide too many grounds for her father to say no or to object to something. By the time she asked for the money, even if I had said no to the money, her permission to go to the party was already secured, so her risk was minimized. The overnight stay would be just a great bonus, and it was much more likely now that I was in a yes mood, having said yes to the first couple of things. But even if I said no, she would object and she would beg a little bit, but after all, she already had two of the three things that she was asking for, so she would be doing just fine. Besides, if I denied her the overnight trip this time, next weekend she would ask me for an overnight trip at Sarah's house instead. Now, because I said no today, that would give my daughter negotiating power for the next time when she wants to stay over at somebody else's house. One way or the other, she would get everything that she wanted. That's my daughter. In the first example, let's go back. We talked about Peter trying to recruit Mary, and his mistake was that he asked her for too big a yes. His chances with Mary would have been enhanced if he made the simple request for her to join his network marketing business, period. After she made the decision, he could have demonstrated the benefits of training and then described to her the fun and the excitement of going to Detroit with him to be trained by the successful millionaires. Apply this wisdom to your selling game, and you will win, inning by inning. Remember, the game is not won in the first round. Here's an important note about this example. The thing that caused Mary to think Peter was asking too much was not that the entire proposition cost too much. Even if the $499 required to join the business, plus the cost of going to Detroit, amounted to $3,000, which it didn't, that would not be the point. The point is that he was bundling too many decisions and asking her for one yes to all of them together. It was too much to expect one yes to cover. Here are the things he was bundling: joining the business, spending $499, giving up a weekend, participating in the Detroit event, spending the extra money to go to Detroit. Again, keep it simple. Make it easy for your customer to say yes, one decision at a time. Otherwise, bundle the decisions in a more meaningful, appealing way with incentives, such as a big discount, so that you can draw the yes that you desire to have. Reason number four for getting a no. Nah, I don't want it. At this point, you should know the answer to such a response based on our earlier discussion about the differences between needs and wants. In order to minimize the likelihood of such a response, it is necessary to perform steps 1 and 4 very well in the 5-step selling process. First of all, in step 1, review the situation and do it expertly. You closely associate what you have to offer with resolving the pressures and problems and pains and challenges that your customer or your prospect is facing. Second, in step 4, when you demonstrate what's in it for me, and you make a connection to the desired end states of the customer or the prospect, you are actually reinforcing the desirability of your offer. It is your job to paint the picture correctly so that your customer or your prospect does not remain in the need zone, where that which is necessary can be postponed. Your role is to transport the person to the future for immediate impact, or bring the person from the future to the present to get a taste of the coming reality. In so doing, the need with its future consequence becomes a want that has an immediate appeal and that leads to fulfillment of desires and a buying decision right now. Even if you do not make the sale, you will have done your job to minimize the chances of refusal based on a lack of desire. And after all, that's all you can do. When you have done it well, sometimes the customer will say no, but never let the customer say no because you've not done it well. Reason number 5. Nah, it's too expensive. Think about your own experience when you're confronted with the buying decision where somebody wants you to have or to take or to acquire something. When you conclude that it is too expensive, Is it ever because it is absolutely impossible for you to get the money necessary? Is it ever true that such a sum of money is so large that no human being you know could ever come up with it, outside of being a billionaire? I think you would agree with me that that's not typically the reason why something is too expensive. That's not how it works, is it? After all, how often have you ever been pitched on buying a spacecraft that costs $750 million? That would be too expensive, I suspect. So what then makes a thing too expensive if we say it's too expensive when it's not too huge a sum of money? Something is not too expensive because the required price is impossible to find or pay. Rather, being too expensive is a perception based on relative value. If you tell me I must pay $100, and my perception is that the merchandise you're offering is worth no more than $50, then I have not been convinced that the value you represent is worth $100. Now, with that in mind, it's really too expensive. And with that understanding, let's go forward to find solutions. Here is a solution. Your job is to paint a crystal clear picture of how beneficial, how valuable, and how worthwhile your idea or proposition is for the customer or the prospect. Your job is to ensure that the customer or prospect sees how well your offer relieves the present pain or attracts future pleasure, or does both. Your job is to ensure that you do not sell your idea based on price, because price is just a feature, not even a benefit, and it certainly is not a desired end state. Selling based on price is a critical strategic and philosophical mistake that is made by even some successful multi-billion dollar companies. Selling by price is the resort of the non-strategic peddler. Buy it from me because it's cheap. Buy it from me because it is at a discount. Buy it from me because my price is lower than my competitor's price. This is not an attempt to say that price is unimportant. Clearly, it is relevant to some buyers and very critical to other buyers. Instead, this is an attempt to show that price should not be a lead consideration when presenting your proposition. In some cases, it should not be a main consideration at all unless the customer or prospect attempts to make it so. Let us review a discussion from an earlier chapter. People do not buy because of features. People do not buy because of sterile benefits. They buy because of desired end states. And desired end states include personal conditions like confidence, feeling good, looking good, social acceptance, self-image, recognition, reputation, happiness, taste, and on and on. These end states are not practical. They're not necessarily functional or utilitarian. They are most often psychological, experiential, and feelings-based. This is true for something as functional and practical as a box of soap to wash my clothes. It is desirable ultimately because it gives me the confidence to wear my clothes in public without fear of rejection due to bad smells or dirty appearances on my person. Now, here is the strategic and the philosophical mistake that so many make. Because the customer's desired end states are typically experiential, emotional, and feelings-based, they cannot be measured quantitatively. How do you measure love and security and acceptance? On the other hand, price is a quantitative measure of providing value. When we emphasize the feature of pricing, or we push the discount as a benefit without realizing it, we invite the customer or the prospect to measure what we offer by quantitative means primarily. In so doing, we trivialize and we devalue the desired end states our products or our services are supposed to be providing, and that minimizes the perceived value of what we offer. Think about it for a moment. and ensure that you get this point. This line of reasoning may be difficult for those who have spent their lives assuming that price is the primary consideration in the buying decision. If you are one of those people, I invite you to get over it quickly. It is costing you money. The masters do not hesitate to sell the most expensive item in their toolkit. The amateurs who are fixated on price doubtfully reach down into their kit, bring up the cheapest, most highly discounted item to sell. Those that typically carry the lowest commissions, and often enough, the lowest quality. This leads to another rather intriguing observation. After decades of seeing research from my clients around the world, I am firmly convinced that in the general case, the psychological impact of prices is quite contrary to what most suppliers and salespeople believe. Take a shopper, for example. When she encounters two similar products, one with a very high price and the other with a very low price, in general, she instinctively and immediately perceives that the one with the higher price is of higher quality and that it is better than the one with the lower price. This impression may change based on some other considerations, but it is important to note the instinctive response. On the other hand, a supplier or a manufacturer who desires to make a product that is similar to other products on the market, very often chooses a low price point to be very competitive, thinking that pricing will be the best way to attract shoppers away from those other similar products. I once heard the story of a perfume manufacturer whose product was sitting on department store shelves and hardly selling at all. The manufacturer eventually tried one last tactic to save the brand, because the department stores were about to discontinue that slow-moving item. The manufacturer tripled the price overnight, despite the protests of the retailers. And the strangest thing happened. The product began to sell. The perfume quickly developed the reputation of being exquisite, upscale, and premium. At this point, let me say I recognize that the subject of pricing is very complex and that this discussion does not come close to addressing all the dynamics. However, further discussion on the subject goes well beyond the reach of this book. In my management consulting business, I work with clients on a variety of related considerations, and I've done this for decades. Pricing, for example, and the consumer decision process at the point of purchase. How does the consumer make decisions and where does price fit into all of that? Price elasticity, for example, and the percentage discount that is necessary to generate maximum incremental volume. Another example is the strategy of high prices with occasional promotional discounts. Another example is the strategy of everyday low prices without discounts versus high-low combinations. Another example is price relative to the competitors or relative to other sizes or relative to other forms and flavors. Let it be sufficient to say the following. You commit a strategic error if you develop a highly sensitive approach to pricing and you present it to your customer or your prospect as a key influencer. Your effort should be spent in building the perception of value for what you offer. Make it so attractive that the customer or the prospect is willing to pay the price you ask without objection. Will this always work? No. But when it does not work, let it not be because you have been non-strategic in your approach to pricing. Let us go back to our example of Peter trying to sell Mary on joining his business. If you build the perception of value high enough and the customer or prospect literally does not have the $499 required, that money can materialize in quick order. Do you doubt that? If you do, then answer this question. How does someone who literally does not own $50,000 to his name buy a house with a price of $300,000? It happens all the time, doesn't it? People find money to do what they desire to do, not necessarily what they need to do or should do. Your job is to present so effectively that you build great desire for what you have to offer. Price then becomes a mere tactical consideration that separates the buyer temporarily from the desired end state of having what you offer. Reason number 6. Nah, What's in it for me? This particular answer does not require much discussion at this point. It is clear that when the reason for no is based on this kind of response, the salesperson has not done an adequate job of step number one, situation review, and step number four, what's in it for me? One subtle distinction needed is to ensure that you do not make the error that so many salespeople make. The what's in it for me is often interpreted as benefits that the product or the service or the idea will generate. But until you show me that the benefit is personal to me, it will not matter that my department or my company or the world at large is going to benefit. Yes, buying soap from you will help my company gain profits, and that's a good thing. But I get more interested in your soap when you help me make the connection that working with you, as opposed to your competitors, I can more quickly fulfill my quota, accomplish my job objectives, and gain the recognition that I desire from my peers and my boss. Remember, people buy for selfish reasons. Even if I'm buying a book for my son, my selfish reason is that it makes me feel good about being a loving parent who cares for his family. I enjoy seeing my son get ahead. It ultimately comes back to my feeling good and right and wonderful about the decision. Reason number seven. Nah, you didn't ask. Does it sound strange that somebody would say no to a question that is not asked? Well, if all of that sounds strange, you may find the following to be even more so strange, in fact, peculiar. Would you believe that many salespeople make presentations and stop short of asking for the order? Now that's odd. Yet it happens more times than you might imagine. It might even happen with you. Many salespeople are timid or they're simple-minded. They think that somehow if they present their wares very clearly to the customer or prospect, the benefits will be so evident, so powerful, that intelligent people will know what they're expected to do to join or to buy. That is not necessarily so. You may be amazed to know how many people will listen to your presentation as education or awareness and then do nothing at all unless you ask them to take action. Leave nothing to implications when you're in the selling game. Let the person know what decisions and actions you want. Simply ask. As indicated earlier, you do not have to get a literal yes or a no for that matter. If you want to bring your presentation to a decisive close, you don't need a full response. You do not always have to ask your customer or prospect, will you buy it? Or do you agree with the idea? Instead, you could end by saying, okay, I'll fax the purchase order to your assistant this afternoon, or how do you spell your last name as you begin to complete the form for your prospect to sign? You don't have to sit back and wait for the customers to say a full yes. You can initiate the action based upon asking the right way. Recall that the fifth step in the persuasive presentation power process is next steps. This is where you ask the customer or the prospect to buy what you're selling and take actions necessary to make the decision real. By simply suggesting a set of actions, you're imputing yes, knowing that if the customer or the prospect disagrees, you're going to find out immediately. Remember, in life, what you do not ask for, you do not get. Ask for big deals, huge agreements. Ask for massive opportunities. Ask and you shall receive, as we discussed in an earlier chapter. Even when you ask and you get a no, in so doing, you have raised the possibility of yes. Besides, a no today can become a negotiating point to get a yes tomorrow. Also, a no to this offer, let's call it offer A, can become a negotiating point for getting a yes to the next offer, let's call it offer B. Never let it be said that you did not get what you want because you did not ask. Here's the eighth reason. No, there's no rush. When you get this kind of response from your customer or your prospect, it is your fault. It is your fault for not delivering with passion and a sense of excitement, for not creating a sense of urgency and immediacy about the decision that you desire. When you deliver a presentation, if you are boring, dispassionate, or if you are simply ordinary in your conviction about what you're offering, that creates the space for your customer or your prospect to consider no or to procrastinate. When you deliver with excitement, with belief, with energy, when you create such a suction force that it pulls your listeners toward what you offer, then you have a greater chance of getting yes. Now, some may argue, well, I'm not such a demonstrative kind of person. If I get excited just to make the sale, my friend or my customer who knows me is going to see something false and know that I'm just putting on. Imagine that response. I want to make just two comments about that kind of concern, if you think it's not your personality to show energy. First, the only people likely to believe that are those who regard themselves as being boring. That's not a good or bad thing necessarily. It may just be the way it is. Second, if your communication is normally plain, boring, non-energized, then when you get excited about a proposition, you get attention. This leads your customer, your prospect, or your friend to believe that there's something different, something special going on, and they had better pay attention. Something special enough that it makes you energized where you are not normally so. Attention increases the chances of interest, and interest increases the chances of getting yes. Let me hasten to add, however, that in order to convey energy and passion, you don't have to use affectation. In other words, artificial or contrived behavior that seems unnatural. You don't have to flail your arms and jump about with excitement and speak in a shrill voice. The sense of urgency can be equally conveyed by your choice of words and by the intensity of your gaze and by the power of your speech. You look directly into the eyes of the prospect and slowly, with emphasis, say something like this. Isn't it true that month after month you're under pressure to meet your quota and to deliver your sales objectives? This promotional program I just outlined will have an explosive effect on your numbers for the next year. I know it because I will be personally involved in every one of the four quarters to make sure that implementation is flawless. But it is important to notice that the allowances are front-loaded, and so we cannot afford to miss the first quarter. The first blockbuster event is going to create a natural momentum for the other three events to follow. All we need for now is getting your okay, and I'm going to talk with the merchandisers and with the store operations people to make sure that this happens. Perhaps your business would require a different kind of conversation. So here's another. You look directly into the eyes of the prospect and slowly with emphasis, you say something like this. This is one of those events that can truly be called the opportunity of a lifetime. We are not looking for average, mediocre people who are satisfied with the mundane. We are not looking for timid, procrastinating people who are unsure of themselves. Instead, we're looking for those who have a deep hunger to do something significant in their lifetime. I believe such a person is you. If you agree, my company will do everything possible to equip and to train you to gain total financial freedom. Are you open to the possibility of doing something extraordinary starting today? The big challenge for some salespeople is that in order to communicate with passion, they have to live with passion. Living with passion is a concept so far removed from their state of being that even speaking with passion seems too big a stretch. However, that's the subject of another one of my books, the one called If Caterpillars Can Fly, So Can I. If you suffer at all from finding the passion in your life not big enough, not hot enough, this book can stir you up and it can ignite fire in your belly. But for now, let's just agree that you will never lose a sale because your audience perceives no need for urgency or that the decision can be easily postponed. So now we have covered the 8 reasons for getting no based upon the head of the bug or based upon the thinking of the bug. The next section covers the reasons for no based upon the thorax, the positioning that leads to no. We have addressed the most typical sources of no that are based on the head or the thinking of your customers or prospects. The solution to each of those responses is based on how you deliver your presentation. Let us now move to the thorax, or the positioning of your customers or prospects. At times you get no, not because your presentation was poor, but because it was not directed to the right person. These responses may sound like this: no, why me? No, who cares? It's not my money. No, life stinks. The solution to each of these responses is based on the effectiveness of your preparation, how well you do your homework prior to presenting your idea or your offer. Let's examine each one separately and see how to avoid it. And so here's reason number 9, the first one under the thorax. No, why me? Have you ever presented to the wrong person? I have. I got to the end of my presentation and asked for permission to put the display into all 26 stores in the retail chain. Why in the name of all that's sacred did Cheryl not tell me that she had no authority at all to agree to what I was asking? She made me sweat through it, and then she actually said, "I don't think that will work." I was mystified because the program made sense. It would make money for the chain. I would be doing a lot of the work. She could watch and sit by and have money flowing into her business. And yet a few days later, I discovered that authorization of store displays was the job of the division manager, and Cheryl, the buyer, she only decided on inventory orders. Sometimes you may get a no, and the prospect or the customer will not tell you why. You may not know that a yes could be forthcoming if only you would repeat the presentation to the right person. This applies beyond the corporate purchasing office. So let us say, for example, that you're selling vitamins to a man on behalf of his family. He may say no to you, but he may never tell you that it is his wife that handles the budget and that if he dares to add a $35 monthly expense, he would be flogged and denied of vital bodily needs. His ego may not allow him to admit that it is his wife who makes such decisions, and you may never know by just talking with him. And then at other times you may present your idea to one person without success because it is a group or a committee that needs to make the decision. There are many new sales representatives who have suffered bruises on their foreheads and damaged self-confidence for many months simply because they present to one buyer when the decision should have been presented to a buying committee. The solution to this type of response happens ahead of time in your preparation phase. Do your research to find out who makes decisions in the areas of your offer. In some cases, asking a few simple questions before beginning the presentation may tell you that you're standing in front of the wrong person and may make it necessary to move and find the right audience for what you present. Reason number 10. No, who cares? It's not my money. I was a regional sales manager working for a large consumer products manufacturer in my early career. One of my customers was Kroger Food Stores in Detroit, Michigan. Now, I'm going to disguise the names just to protect the guilty. You see, my buyer, let's call him Larry, he had made some very bad decisions in the past, but this one was the mother of all bad decisions. At least I thought so. I had a pool of $24,000 left over for promotional funding that I was ready to give to Kroger. The allowance would expire in another 3 weeks. He would not be able to get it if he waited just 3 weeks more. All that Larry needed to do was to qualify minimally by just running a small ad in the company circular and by authorizing a small health and beauty aids displays that would go to only 20% of the retail stores. That's it. And he would get the money. I had designed an easy to execute program that required very little on his part. On top of all that, my benefits were strong. He would make no added investment, and this money would go straight to Larry's bottom line as net profits. At his current profit margins, he would have needed to sell $2.6 million worth of groceries to gain $24,000 in profits, the equivalent of what I was offering him just for that simple display in 20% of the stores. Instead, I would simply send him a check for that amount. Done. End of story. At the end of my presentation, he looked at me with a bored expression. He dismissed my idea, and he said, "What else you got?" I couldn't believe it. I had never come closer to strangling a client in my entire business career. See, at that time in my early 20s, my income was only about $25,000 per year. And Larry actually allowed the funds to expire. The equivalent of a year's salary was flushed down the drain, and he was totally unconcerned about it. Well, after a few weeks of questioning my own sanity, I learned something about how Kroger's works. Let me repeat my frequent cry, however, before going on. Ignorance is certainly not bliss. Ignorance will cost you money, performance, promotions, and all kinds of good, desirable things in your life. I learned that if an allowance is directly deducted from the invoice for products bought by Kroger, the buyer gets credit in the form of a lower cost of goods, and that's good for the buyer. On the other hand, when the money comes after the purchase and comes as a lump sum check or a total fund, the credit goes to the advertising department and it helps to defray costs such as company circulars and promotions. Now, Larry, the buyer, he did not report to advertising where the lump sum check actually would go. Instead, he reported to the purchasing department. Furthermore, net profit was not one of those factors that determined Larry's salary and bonus. He couldn't care less if we were forfeiting 10 times that amount in terms of net profit. My $2.6 million was of no interest to Larry at all because it was a measure that the total corporation Kroger cared about, not something by which he was measured. Huh. Now, you may argue that Larry was selfish. You may argue that he did not have the best interests of his company at heart. You may argue that he made a bad business decision, or you may even agree with me that he was not the sharpest nail in the toolbox. However, all of that would be completely irrelevant. People will not behave consistently in a manner that is contrary to their personal benefits and their desired end states. After all, the problem was not with the individual buyer. The problem was with the organizational design at Kroger that would prevent Larry from getting personal credits for his efforts to attract $24,000 to the company's coffers. It is your responsibility to learn how the decision process works for your customer or your prospect. Otherwise, you may get a no that mystifies you. The answer could well be that your buyer doesn't care because it's not his money. In other words, saying no and missing an opportunity doesn't matter if he is not the one who stands to lose the benefits anyway. The solution to this kind of no lies in the preparation stage where you identify the stakeholders. Find out if the person to whom you are presenting is the one who cares about what you offer. Occasionally, you'll find that the benefits and desired end states from your presentations do not necessarily impact that person, do not impact that person at all, and then you need a new audience for your proposition. Reason number 11. No, life stinks. What do I care? I have a business associate in New York who once told me that some people are so negative that if you put them in a dark room, they will develop. What a thought. Did you ever walk away from a presentation with the firm conviction that the only reason you didn't make the sale was that the customer or prospect was a son of a breech? That the buyer was a hijo de la gran fruta? or whatever the language, some people simply have a nasty disposition that makes them disagreeable and unlikely to say yes. If you are selling to an extremely negative person, one with a dreadful outlook on life, then you need guerrilla tactics. So consider this example. There are two primary stimuli that motivate human beings to take action. One is the desire to gain pleasure, and the other is the desire to avoid pain. When you present to a person whose positioning is that life stinks, the promise of pleasure is not believable enough to be attractive. Anything that seems really good will definitely be too good to be true. You will not entice such a person to action through positive end states and desirable benefits that will make that person feel better. On the other hand, if you can apply the cattle prod of impending doom and painful outcomes, such a pessimist can relate to that. Such a pessimist is far more likely to follow you away from the pain and do what you suggest. Isn't that amazing? Try it, and you may be surprised at how often it works. Imagine this dialogue with your next life stinks bug. You may begin this way. Help me understand something. How do people survive today? Jobs don't pay enough, and then the government takes a massive chunk of taxes out of your paycheck. And with the little that's left, you're expected to pay for food and shelter and clothing and take care of your family. And then the money runs out before the next paycheck comes. The next thing you know is you're 65 years old, broke and tired, and then you die. How the dickens do people make it these days? Pause for negative input and commiseration. And then you might continue. What the heck? I decided to do something radical about it. I started a part-time home business with a company that shows me how to get paid as I sleep. I'm talking about passive income over and above what I make on my job. There's no way that the system is going to leave me broke and miserable. I'm going to fight it and I'm going to win. A year or two from now, I'm going to have financial independence. I don't care how many people get laid off or how bad the economy gets. They're not going to make me go to my grave miserable. Say, Sam, do you want to learn some more about how this part-time home business works? Let's kick some butt together. If you pardon the expression. Do you have to be negative to sell to a negative person? No. But you will try this tactic if you really want a yes. Your pessimistic language gives such a buyer the room for self-expression. The buyer then believes, oh, here's one salesperson that is realistic and not a pie-in-the-sky dreamer. Put a bubbling, charming, optimistic salesperson up against a sour, pessimistic, mean-spirited buyer, and it will be like mixing oil and water. The customer or prospect will even resent that fresh, positive outlook, and that customer may work harder to prove the salesperson wrong. The salesperson is laden with promises of increased sales and profitability and financial securities or health or a sense of well-being. So here's what is likely to be going on inside the thorax of this stink bug, or pardon again the expression, this person who thinks that life stinks. Ah, this kid is not for real. What the heck is he thinking? Life's not a bed of roses. Fine for him driving up here all dressed up in his new car and pitching me on his next wonderful piece of trash. He doesn't know the kind of world I live in day after day. Doesn't he know that nothing is perfect? Give me a break. Enough already. Jeez. I know this response. Because I have lived through it, trying to sell to clients who perceived themselves to be stuck in a dead-end job. And then once in a while, once a week or so, here I would come in my fancy duds, riding high and expecting them to roll over and act like I was the answer to all their prayers. A few of them even verbalized that resentment to me with colorful expletives to make sure I did not miss the point. I had to learn how to take off a little of the shine, how to get off my high horses and deal with people at a level where they have to live every single day of their lives. My final advice on this subject is that despite the tactics of meeting the negative buyer with negative stimuli, some are so negative that they will say no anyway. The solution in those cases may simply be to move on. Find another person who does not require so much energy. If you must call repeatedly on the same corporate buyer and that corporate buyer happens to be that negative, then first of all, let me say, may God have mercy on your soul. Second, in order to succeed, you're going to have to refine and apply guerrilla tactics that you learn here and in other places. Watch out. Those for whom life stinks are not looking for perfume. And so finally, we get to the abdomen, that last segment of the bug, the part that is based upon gut feeling and often leads someone to say no. Let's now move on to what goes on in the stomach of your buyer, that emotional response that may not be positive. The responses will include these two rationales. I don't trust or like you, so no. I don't trust or like it or like them, so no. The solution to each of these responses is based on developing a better relationship with those from whom you expect yes. The lack of trust develops secondary syndromes like fear, apprehension, and doubt. And all of these move people closer to saying no to you. So here's the first one. No, I don't like you or I don't trust you. Do you regard yourself as a pretty good person that everyone should like and trust? The truth is, being a pretty good person has very little to do with whether or not people like and trust you. If they do not like and trust you, your sales business is very difficult. People buy from people they like and trust. Let's examine the two most typical reasons that I've found for personal dislike and distrust in the selling situation. One typical reason is that you're a stranger. First of all, you may not be a bad person. It may just be that you are a stranger. If the person to whom you're selling does not know you, that person may not necessarily distrust or dislike you. He or she may just not have enough time and enough contact with you to know who you are, to develop the trust. Depending on the type of sales that you do, it may be inevitable that you deal with many strangers. Fortunately, there are a number of things that you can do to build immediate rapport with people. Covering such a topic in depth goes well beyond the purpose of this chapter. However, here are a few simple tips that work. 1. Smile. 2. Call people by their names. 3. Ask questions to get people talking about themselves and things that they like. 4. If they speak slowly, do not speak quickly. If they speak quickly, do not drag your speech. Match their verbal intensity. It helps them to feel more comfortable with you. Now, you cannot avoid the risk of some people liking or disliking you based on their own prejudices. If you're aggressive and pushy, some people may object to whatever you're selling, while others may welcome you as a go-getter, somebody who knows how to get things done. If you're mild and meek-mannered, some may regard you as good and wonderful, but others may see you as being weak and ineffective in your business. What's the solution? Look for points of similarities between you and your customer or your prospect. Discuss and emphasize those similarities. People are afraid of many shadows. The knowledge that you are in some way like the person to whom you're selling will help to dispel the shadows. And finally, number 13. No, I don't like it. Or I don't trust it. Or I don't like it or I don't trust them. This is another shade of the problem in the previous section. Some people are hesitant to buy because they dislike and they distrust the brand name or the company. If the reputation of the company or the brand is tarnished, you may have some difficulty in selling what you have to sell. Now, when I was a salesperson selling for a massive soap company in Cincinnati, Ohio, there were times when my clients simply disliked the company that I represented, and as a result, they looked forward to reasons to say no to me. I can recall having to arrange a top-to-top presentation between my senior management and the senior executives at my retail client. The objective of the presentation was not to sell a product or a program, but to build credibility. The focus was to familiarize the client with our values, our purpose, and the ways in which we do business. We were seeking to impress the client with our integrity, with our commitment, with our resources, and with our creativity in the business. We wanted them to see us as a viable partner who would help them build their business. If you are selling to individuals outside the corporate sales office, you need to spend some time making them familiar with your business in a very favorable light. Share copies of positive press and publicity about your company and your products. Tell them of humanitarian efforts to which your company is committed. Get third parties to share this belief about your company with them. If such customers or prospects are potentially very important, invite them to take a tour of your company, to go to the headquarters and see how you're laid out and what your departments are like and meet the management. Invite them to participate in a three-way phone call with a company executive who's willing to support your success. Do whatever is right and practical to improve the impression that your customers or your prospects have about your company and about your brands. You may be the only representative of the company that they've met so far. So do everything that you can to represent your company and yourself in the very best light. And so in conclusion, here's the bottom line. Mediocre players in the selling game burn much energy in the emotional aftermath of getting no. The masters in the game, on the other hand, use that energy to reach more people. The masters dissect no, and they build strategies to move on until they encounter the next yes. Mastery is available to you. You don't have to be born with it. It is but a matter of diligent practice and a few skill-building techniques. Here are the three macro steps to squash the no bug. Sharpen your presentation skills with the five steps of persuasive presentation. Improve your preparation and learn more about your customer or prospect. And finally, create and maintain cooperative relations with the people with whom you do business.